decision because the old Ms., the glossy Ms. magazine, used to get into terrible trouble from both sides, from the women's movement for taking ads for products that were either harmful in general or harmful specifically to women or exploited women, because we all know if you have an ad these days for an automotive battery, you're going to have some scantily clad woman standing there with the battery nestled between her chests. And it just happens. It's terrible. It's unfortunate. People should write their congressman or something. I don't know what people should do in order to stop the exploitation of women in advertising. Because if you boycott the product, you'll end up starving to death and living in a hole in the ground, because it seems like every single product is touched with this disgusting advertising. So anyway, Robin Morgan and Gloria Steinem were getting flack, if not AK-47 fire, from the feminist movement because of taking any advertising at all. Because of the exploitative nature of it all, and also for taking cigarette advertising, for taking alcohol advertising, for, you know. But if they didn't, they would have gone under, and they would have gone under big, because advertising is, unfortunately, everything to these slick magazines. And a monthly slick magazine. And when they stopped taking certain advertising, seeing as how everybody knows everybody else in the business, other accounts decided not to advertise with them and in their magazines. It was just a terrible thing. So what happened was Gloria Steinem really couldn't handle it anymore, basically. And she went on to do other things. She writes, she's a frequent contributor to this version of Ms., and she's gotten a lot, gotten herself back together and a lot better by not having to worry about this anymore, by not having those terrible headaches of running a monthly slick magazine. And what Robin Morgan did was just let it lay low for almost 2 years, and it came back with a whole new sensibility. This Robin Morgan, who is another one of my great, great heroes of all time, was an activist, still is an activist, but came to prominence as an activist in the very early women's movement, 68, 69, 70, as the editor of Sisterhood is Powerful, which was the anthology of the women's liberation movement in 1970. It was the thing to be reading, and I fortunately have a copy of it now again, and am able to go back and vicariously relive my radical student high school days, because I was 15 in 1970, and I was striking, and I was, you know, going off the deep end about women's rights in high school. And being an activist in those days, you really and a poet, and a fine poet at that, you really couldn't escape getting involved with manifesto publishing, mimeograph, underground press releases, magazines, manifestos, anything, pamphlets, leaflets. That was a real time of the press, literally the mimeograph press. Anyone who had access to a mimeo and a typewriter was just out there. It was great. And now that I put out my own small publication on a computer and a laser printer, the new 90s version or the 80s version of the Mimeo machine, it's just a lovely thing. It's revolutionized, or it should indeed revolutionize, underground publications again. If you go to a place called See Here, H-E-A-R, on 7th Street. Where are they? They're on 7th between 1st and A, something like that, down in the East Village. They have got underground publications, as in Fact Sheet 5, various music magazines that are true, like, guerrilla publications, and they're great. They're done on computers with usually dot matrix printers, which doesn't give you the print quality, but you can still read it. And the technology is now inexpensive enough to be in enough people's hands so that there should be indeed an underground renaissance of guerrilla publications. And I look forward to that. This, on the other hand, is not quite that that way. It is a, how do I describe this magazine? It is not glossy. It is not one of those magazines, those poor unfortunate magazines on the high gloss coated stock where you try to read it with an overhead light and you can't because the glare is blinding you. It's printed on beautiful paper, beautiful, dull, but white paper. And it, the art design is just lovely. It's different for every issue, and it works as a whole. In this particular issue, there are a few, let's see, the special features are on women and race, a special report from Burma. Robin Morgan believes very highly in sisterhood is global. That is her her philosophy, and she does her best in this magazine to cover all parts of the world, what women are doing for themselves in India, in Bangladesh, in Vietnam, everywhere, in all parts of Africa, in all parts of Asia, Russia, and just everywhere, South America. There are a lot of very good things in this issue, too many to mention. And the reason I brought it in, and the reason I wanted to talk about it so much, is because after reading those two stories last week on the merfolk, what do I find in here this week but an excerpt of a book that's coming out in September, written by Robin Morgan, and it's called The Merchild. And I thought to myself, oh, you trendsetter, you. You didn't even realize great minds think alike and all this. And I thought I would come in. Well, I had two opinions about this. One was that I could just tell you about it and have you, you know, demand that you go out and get it yourself because it's so marvelous, or I could tease you by reading this excerpt, which is all there is in this, in the magazine, and then have you rush out even more enthused and really make a concerted effort to try to find Ms. Magazine, because, like I said, it is not easy to find it. You have to go to a large periodical, magazine, newspaper, book-type store like Hudson News on Broadway and 8th Street, on or St. Mark's Books. Judith's Room would have it, I think, at 681 Washington Street. Any and all feminist bookstores, right? Like there's one on every corner. If you happen to know of one and you go there, they will probably have it. But I wanted to read this one for you as my wild card story this morning. I've been reading a pair of stories that have something to do with one another, plus one wild card story. And the two stories this morning are going to be on Snow White. One is a rather collective and socialist utopian version of Snow White, which is really neat, from the anthology Don't Bet on the Prince by Jack Zipes. And the other is from Red is Blood by Tanith Lee. And the I'll be reading the title story, but let me read for you a legend for children and other adults, as she calls it, by Robin Morgan. And this is called The Merchild. It will be available in bookstores in September or earlier, and it will be put out by the Feminist Press at the City University of New York. I'll give you that again after I finish. Once upon a time that may or may not come again, there lived a merchild. He had pale green skin, translucent as sea foam, and his body sloped to a tail that glittered like a prism in the sun, each scale reflecting a different shimmer of the rainbow, crimson and cobalt, lilac and gold. His hair was surf white, ringleted as the froth that crests as a wave. But his eyes were the strangest of all. They were speckled and whorled like the spirals of the sundial shell. He was very beautiful. His mother was a mermaid, his father a human. Long, long ago they had fallen in love. For her sake, his father, a mariner, forsook his own kind and entered the depths of the sea. His comrades thought him lost. The sea folk, in turn, forsook the mermaid, pronouncing her lost, for mermaids were not supposed to love mortals. The sea folk would not even own the mermaid's child because it was half human. The mermaid and her mariner had one another, and they loved their child dearly. But their suffering had made them forever grown up, and they were now complete unto themselves. The merchild had no one of his own. He was very lonely. Sometimes he played with the young porpoises or sang with the great whales. Sometimes he joined in the favorite games of the whiskered walruses, in which you deliberately entangled yourself in seaweed chains and then tumbled through the depths, bouncing lightly against the coral reefs and bunking into one another. But the merchild was, after all, not a young porpoise, or a great whale, or a whiskered walrus. He never quite belonged. He had tried to play with human children. The first time he ever saw one paddling about in the water, he swam right up to it, and not knowing what else to do, bonked playfully into it as he would into a friendly walrus. The child screamed and darted back to shore, where it babbled about sea monsters and was cooed over by laughing adult humans. Another time there was a tiny girl. She was not afraid, but she tried to catch the merchild and drag him up onto the beach. He barely escaped. One summer the merchild actually did make friends, he thought, with a boy about his own age, a boy who seemed fearless and almost as at home in the water as the merchild himself. But a day came when the boy insisted on racing him. Even though the merchild refused again and again, and even though when he finally gave in, he then paddled as slowly as he knew how, still he reached the finish point long before his human companion. The boy turned on him, eyes aglow with hate, and sputtered, "Who cares anyway? Who could be jealous of you? If your mother was a mermaid, then she lured your father to death, that's what. Mermaids do that to humans. Everybody knows they do. Your mother was a murderess and your father was a dummy. Or maybe your father tried to catch your mother and fry her for dinner, huh? Either way, it makes me want to throw up. It's so disgusting. And you're not a person or a fish. Freak, you don't fit in anywhere." "That's not true," cried the merchild. "My mother and father loved each other. How could you ever understand them? He never tried to capture her, and she never tried to drown him. All your stories about sea folk are lies." "Oh, yeah?" sneered the boy. He clambered up on some rocks and stood with his legs planted wide apart and his arms folded. He wiggled his toes. He bent his knees in a deep squat and then straightened up. He kicked out first one leg and then the other. He balanced on his left foot and waggled the right foot in the air defiantly as if it were a flag. "Let me see you do this, scaly tail. Race me on land and see who wins. You're not a real boy. I bet no self-respecting fish plays with you either. Else why are you hanging out around with people so much, huh? Where's all your fishy friends? Or are you Mr. Special Hot Stuff, the only merchild in the world? What if I am? I mean," the merchild stammered, "there are lots of other sea folk. Ondines and naiads and tritons. They're water nymphs and river sprites and merwins. And they all love me. They play with me whenever I want to and do whatever I ask them to. He fell silent, drenched with the shame of his lie. The boy was not impressed. Still jeering, he danced off further inland, but his taunts floated back to the merchild in a sing-song snarl on the wind. Fish boy, you and your squid kid pals, you're not even real. I made you up. You never existed at all. The merchild watched him go through shell-whirl eyes. After that, he didn't try to make friends with human children, although he often gazed at them from a distance, longingly. He would watch until the beach was utterly deserted, and then turn his gaze toward the vast unbroken surface of the sea. Sometimes a sea swallow might fly overhead and drop him a gray-green feather, like a promise of pity. But he himself was not a sea swallow, or a fish, or a person. The sea folk would not own him. The human folk would not own him. The merchild was very lonely. One day, as he was wondering whether to follow the dolphins to the southern seas or go ride the Gulf Stream or visit the Great Barrier Reef, he heard the overhead calls of startled sea swallows, and he looked up to see the glossy black-helmeted birds dip and swoop their pearlish gray-green bodies out to sea, as if they'd been surprised during their stroll along the shore. But there on the beach itself, moving slowly across the sand toward the outcropping of the rock, was what seemed at first a bulk with a double head, but which soon became a man carrying a human bundle, what looked like a child wrapped warmly in sweaters and blankets. The man set the child down on a rock and settled himself alongside. For a while they gazed out at the sea, seeming to talk now and then, until the man drew a pad from his pocket and began to sketch. Then, after a while, he lifted the child again and carried his bundle up the path from the cove. The merchild was curious. The next day the strange pair was back, and the next. Within the week the man had begun to leave the child tucked safely into a blanketed nest along the rock outcropping, which gave her a fine view of the sea. He would then go for short walks, returning with shells he had gathered or a drawing he had made of the seascape around the bend of the beach. The child, meanwhile, sat peacefully on the rock perch, sometimes reading a book, but mostly just looking out to sea, often singing a wordless little song unashamedly loud against the crash of the surf. The merchild watched all this through shell-whirl eyes. The human child seemed lonely. One day he dared swim closer. He hid behind a jut in the natural seawall of rocks in order to see the small human more closely. From his hiding place he could spy on the odd person who was, he thought, a little girl, although he couldn't be certain. She seemed to him like no other child he had ever seen. For one thing, she appeared to move only from the waist up whenever she reached for her book or leaned to adjust the blankets tucked about her legs, legs which never seemed to move. She didn't scramble over rocks or run along the sand, or even walk, and she never swam. But her voice went places her body didn't. It bounced off the rock surfaces and echoed over the waves. The merchild thought he had never heard anything so beautiful as her queer, mournful melodies, although they did remind him a little of the courting songs of the humpback whale. Her singing seemed to draw him nearer. He edged in, still hiding. She indeed was like no other child. Her skin was not pink like that of the many early summer children who came to the cove, nor was it the rich, glazed black of the island children on the other shore, the far side of the sea. Instead, she seemed to glow as if from some inside brightness that flickered through the silvery seal brown of all her surfaces, the face and hands giving off a light like a sun-spotted flounder, the eyes almost green-black as the ocean floor and shot with the same tawny flecks. Her hair was short and exclaimed itself in a rush of wiry, tight black curls all over the proud head. When the wind touched her hair, that head looked like a sea anemone riffling itself underwater. Or so the merchild thought. Sometimes, to his amazement, she bent the graceful neck and buried that head in her arms. Then peculiar sounds came from her, more like the grunts of a sea robin than the whale song melodies he loved so. When she shook her head again, her eyes seemed to have rained tiny rivers down her cheeks. The merchild puzzled all this from his hiding place and did not understand. Yet she was lonely. That he recognized. The day came when her father had made certain she was comfortable in her perch and had gone a bit away to set up his easels and paints, and she turned to find her book, but saw, wedged cunningly in the crack beside her usual place, a circle of seaweed as if woven into a crown. She smiled, then placed it promptly on her stiff black curls and sat looking out to sea, a small monarch surveying her immense realm. The circlet had dried brittle by the afternoon's end, but she kept it, pressing it in her book. The next day she found a piece of driftwood in the crevice, a curve of creamy bark scoured by water and salt into a shape like interlocking wings, arched above a double bird body. The next day she deliberately waited until her father was far off down the beach, savoring the expectation. Then she looked. There in the treasure crevice was wedged a shard of mottled blue glass, its edges worn smooth by tidal scrubbings. She peered through it at the sun and saw a horizon blue-green as if she looked up through seawater into air. The next day her father offered to sit with her a while, but she impatiently urged him to get on with his painting, and only when quite alone did she dare search beside her, down between the stones. Fragile but perfect, a sand dollar laid there, nestled on a cushion of sea moss. The next day, the shell, strung by its natural hole on a velvet ribbon the color of willow leaves, hung around her slender throat. Her father would comment in surprise on his return each afternoon. "The sea must like you to wash up gifts like these," he smiled as he lifted her into his arms. But privately he thought how well she had learned to see treasures right around her, unlike other children who were freer to ignore their immediate surroundings, given a luxury of movement that let them explore wherever they wished. She herself said little, but she always took her treasures with her, and once, when a light rain caused her father to sweep her up in a hasty departure, she made him turn back to retrieve the black and yellow streaked pebble she had found that day. All this time, the merchild watched through shell-whirl eyes. Day after day, he watched her from his hiding place, just the other side of the rock outcropping. Hour after hour, the two of them watched in silence on either side of the seawall, gazing out to sea. It was she who spoke first. "Thank you," she said simply, in the clear voice he knew so well from her singing. "Thank you for my treasures." The merchild was so shocked at being addressed directly that he flipped from his ledge by reflex and splashed loudly into the water. He had darted 2 miles out to sea with excitement before he could slow down and tell himself calmly that she had doubtlessly been talking to the waves and not to him at all. Ashamed of himself, but unable to keep away, he alternately glided and inched back to his observation place. The little girl sat on her rock, but she seemed to be smiling to herself, and she hummed softly as she tickled her chin with the sea swallow feather that had been that day's gift. They spent the rest of the afternoon in silence, although the waves did seem excessively loud. The next day, as they took up their positions on the seawall, she spoke the moment her father was out of earshot. "I'd bring you gifts in return, you know, but I don't get about much. I couldn't gather land flowers or bird feathers or pine cones very easily, you see." The merchild clung to his ledge for dear life and strained to hear over the thudding of his heart, which whammed in repeated tidal waves against his ribs. He told himself again, "Don't be a fool. She's talking to the sea. She doesn't even know you exist." But then she seemed to twist her upper body toward him and called directly across the rock that separated them. "I thought of bringing you a book, you know, but I couldn't think whether a child like you would care for reading. Besides, almost all my books are about sea life, which is hardly something you need to learn about." The merchild's tidal wave heart seemed to stop, and he found himself seriously wondering whether it would ever start again. But start it did, although from the delightful melting sensation that came over him, he all at once realized how a jellyfish must feel. He wriggled a few inches closer and edged up toward the top of the seawall. Holding his breath, he peeked over the barrier rock. The little girl was looking directly into his eyes. "Anemone," was all he could manage. "Anne who?" she asked. "Anne sea anemone," he whispered. "Anemone," he repeated foolishly, "like your head." Then, overcome with embarrassment, he slid down from his rock and vanished in the next wave. The little girl serenely went back to her singing. Still, that was the beginning. The space that separated the two grew smaller day by day, the merchild lying at last in full view of the little girl, although still hidden from sight of anyone on the beach. The afternoons grew shorter as autumn sifted toward darkness. But the conversations grew longer, so much so that the little girl's father wondered if his daughter had taken to talking to herself in her loneliness. He could see her up on her beloved throne, as she called it, from his walk along the beach or his position with his paints. She seemed to be in animated conversation with the sea, gesturing with those strong little arms that tried to compensate for the motionless legs. Yet he trusted his daughter's wisdom. He had learned she knew as well as anyone, sometimes better, what she needed for her own survival. She did, in fact, seem happier than he had ever seen her. As for the merchild, he could no more be kept from his daily appointment than the tide could be kept from coming in. He was delirious. He would chase his own tail with joy. "Your eyes," the little girl announced one day, "are nice. Weird and shivery. Dizzy-making, but nice. Did you know that?" The merchild allowed as to how he hadn't known that. He got suddenly shy, but his tail twitched with pleasure in the shallows. "Well," she went on matter-of-factly, "they are. They sort of spiral. They seem to look in and out at the same time. And they shine so." "Do you cry often?" she asked abruptly.
"Cry? Like the gulls, you mean?"
"Well, no, you know, cry tears. I mean, weep."
"I don't know what weep is," replied the merchild, feeling shamed by his ignorance.
"I cry a lot sometimes," the little girl confessed in a low voice, as if she hadn't heard his admission. Slowly, it came to him that she meant when her eyes rained rivers.
"Oh," he blurted out, "I know when you cry. You weep, and your eyes... waterfall. I've never done that. I don't even know if I can. Is it to be sad or happy?"
"I think it can mean either one or both," she answered. "But I've only ever wept from being sad."
"Ah," the merchild replied, and they said no more that day.
He did ask her at last why she never moved or walked or swam. He asked her very tenderly, as if the question might hurt her, even if he couldn't think why it would. "Oh," she said slowly, "I can't, you see. My legs are paralyzed. That means they won't move or hold me up. Of course, my father says someday there might be a medicine or operation or cure of some sort. You never know. But until then, maybe for always, my body's like other children's only from the waist up." Her eyes, like twin undersea springs, welled with shadowy water. Fascinated, the merchild stared until he realized that she was grieving. "Please," he cried, "please don't be sad." He reached out to touch her for the first time. "I know what you feel. I know. My body is also like other children's from the waist up only." His cool hand with its exquisitely webbed fingers grasped her strong brown one and held it tight. Then she burst into laughter through her tears and said, "Of course. I never thought of it that way before. As if I were sort of a mermaid. It makes us two of a kind, then. Oh, lovely. Oh, lovely, lovely, lovely." She squeezed his hand, then dropped it to clap her own in celebration. The merchild, too, broke out in smiles, and imitating her, beat his hands one on the other in welcome. Theirs was a special world, all unto themselves, its only reality the few hours each afternoon when the little girl's father left her and watched from a distance, until the dreaded moment when he came to gather her up and carry her home again. There was no confidence they couldn't share. She told him how her legs had been useless since her babyhood, probably damaged in the same accident that had taken the life of her never-known mother. She showed him a photograph of that mother, a halibut-skinned woman with the same anemone hair and a smile that warmed your own until you found you were grinning back at the square piece of picture paper. She told him how her father somehow thought the doctors hadn't done all they could have, how her father thought that was because he and her mother weren't welcome in that hospital, since they loved each other but had different color skins. No matter how often she explained this, the merchild couldn't understand it. Her parents had both been human, hadn't they? And the doctors, too?